Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is February 14th, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I want to report we had a great panel at the LAX Hilton this week, weekend, talking about money, magic, and consciousness. Kimberly Gamble, the producer of Thrive, was the host, and we had a wonderful audience. What it tells me is that there is a lot of integration happening in many different worlds, and people are ready to have a serious conversation about, okay, how do we re-engineer the money to shift these things? Coming up April 24th, I'm going to be speaking in Portland, and then we're going to have a lunch for subscribers in Portland, Oregon on April 27th, and then the following one is going to be in Warsaw, Poland in June. So if you are going to be in any of those two places, please make sure to sign up on the blog. Tonight, Precious Metals and Market Report with Franklin Sanders. We have a lot to talk about. I'm also wanting to do a section on shipping, and we'll be talking about shipping tonight, a very important topic at the moment which you have to receive or send precious metals. Our theme tonight is the Vatican falls over the fiscal cliff. Who's next? This is the top story in money and markets, the Pope's resignation, and it's a sign of a very serious meltdown in the finances of the Vatican and the implications that that has for what has arguably been for 2,000 years the most powerful global network and global financial network. I've talked many times about there's a world that's dying and a world that's being born. We're watching the big bureaucracies in the legacy economies really struggle, and this is the mother of all legacy bureaucracies. The Pope Benedict's resignation was announced at the beginning of this week. It's effective at the end of February. It stunned and shocked the world, even though the every effort is now being made to downplay it in the media. It came 6 days after HBO, a subsidiary of Time Warner, ran the documentary Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of the Lambs, on the ever-growing pedophilia scandals which have been engrossing the church. And it did an excellent job of outlining the fact that Pope Benedict's role as head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, known as CDF, from 1981 to 2005, that as in that role, he was the point man managing and suppressing the church liabilities on the pedophilia scandals globally, which were in fact managed very tightly from his office. This is a very big story, a very big financial story, a very important story. So let's follow the money. I'd like to talk about it and focus on it tonight in Money and Markets. What is the church? The Holy Roman Empire receded. It was very expensive to keep armies globally, as the American Empire is now discovering. And instead, it left a church with endowments and land and real estate holdings in its place. Think of the church. The overt part is a church, but the covert part is an investment syndicate that it has enjoyed for 2,000 years diplomatic immunity and tax exemption. The combination of that, as you can imagine, is quite powerful when combined with the economics of compound interest. And you had powerful networks within the church managing that process of diplomatic immunity and tax exemption and the kind of capital that can be accumulated on it, including the Jesuit Society, Opus Dei, and the Knights of Malta. Think of this as the most powerful control file syndicate in the world. And in fact, the church's most powerful asset was their control file syndicate. You had a global network of, think of the churches as storefronts, taking confession from everyone from the powerless to the very powerful, but also running sex slave networks managed through pedophilia. The real story here is not horny priests. The real story is a very powerful financial and money laundering, including very much entwined with narcotics trafficking. You'll know if you watch the documentary, the HBO documentary, Mea Maxima Culpa, that the priests who have been implicated and continuously protected are always successful in raising funds. And that's because the pedophilia is part of creating the control files and the sort of personnel benefits that are helpful in generating those kinds of funds and donation. Now, The church is far from the only institution that's been complicit in this. If you look at who they're competing with, including them, and cooperating, it's a competition and cooperation with the intelligence agencies and the Mason networks or the Masonic networks. Pedophilia is a very old and much more significant tradition than many of us like to understand or face. And again, as I said, narcotics trafficking was a very important part of this network. Now, what is happening? We see Amazon using digital technology basically shut Barnes & Noble down. The economics of the storefront no longer work in the face of the kind of things that can be done online and with digital technology. It's the same thing happening to the Vatican, particularly as a power shift against the what we've been referring to as the breakaway civilization and the intelligence agencies and the Masons who are caught up in that sort of global game of who governs. The Vatican's been running very expensive storefronts, churches all over the world. It's a moneymaker when you're getting a donations, but if your donations slow down and don't cover the overhead, you've got a real problem. Part of the issue is cheap labor. Nuns and priests have provided very high-quality, inexpensive labor for generations. The problems with the things, both the church policies and the event of these scandals, it makes it hard to recruit the necessary priests to fill the parishes. But new technology means that someone can get control files through digital networks, social media, telecommunications, phones in ways that can supplant the confessional of the storefront church and fundamentally change the economics of who has and controls the best control file networks. Globalization means you don't need to necessarily get kids from congregation. You can get them from abroad very easily or cheaply from foster kids and literally now out of the laboratory. So the Vatican's networks are being power shifted by technology. They've become easier to bypass, particularly by networks who are affiliated with central banks. Whatever the Vatican can do with their tax exemption and diplomatic immunity, they don't control currencies, and so they can't print money. We know there were over $1 billion of settlements because of pedophilia in North America in the 80s. Now those settlements appear to total over $3 billion that has been documented. Globally, it's more, and the number of lawsuits and documentation keep growing and sort of boomeranging. This has been devastating to donations, membership. One example, one article this week quoted that parishes were down in Boston. Oh, this was in Mayor Maxima Coppola. Parishes are down in Boston by 50%. This can have a devastating impact to cash flows coming into the church. And this kind of loss of credibility is impacted further by what's happened with the financial crisis 2006 to 2009 and what it did to the credibility of the mainstream churches, of which the Catholic Church is certainly the biggest. This has been devastating across their balance sheet and income statements. So we see revenues going down from donations, expenses going up as it becomes harder to recruit priests and nuns, and more lay workers need to be turned to who require market compensation. And then we have the settlements, which significantly increase the cost. And we've reached a tipping point. With HBO literally taking a very high-quality production and marketing it in a way that brings it all the way up to the Pope's door, you run the risk of these settlements now being able to compromise the real estate holdings of the church's threats of filing liens against various real estate holdings. We saw in 2007 a very major settlement, $660 million in the Los Angeles area, and literally one of the headquarters had to be sold to meet the settlement expenses. We see filings of bankruptcies in different church districts around the world. But this has reached a point where, at this point, if you have a glossy documentary on HBO being screened and shown globally, at a very wide level, you run the risk that you could lose diplomatic immunity, you can lose tax exemption, you can lose the real estate and assets, and things can really spiral out of control. So it's happening at a very interesting time because we're watching the global economy rebalance into the emerging markets, which means membership is growing in the emerging markets, not in the developed world. We're also seeing the repositioning of real estate in the U.S. and Europe, where the church is arguably one of, if not the largest, of the real estate owners. There's a very interesting subtext going on in the politics of Los Angeles. We see, right before the Pope's resignation, real issues around the resignation of the Archbishop in Los Angeles. After the resignation of the Pope, right following that, it's then announced that the Los Angeles Archbishop will be very involved in choosing the new Pope. A lot of squabbling around narcotics trafficking and LAPD in Los Angeles. I said there's only one degree of separation from what's happening on the street to literally the top of the Vatican. If you look at the networks who must be squabbling for this to happen over global control networks and money laundering, that fight no doubt is going to go into the heart of LAPD, which has for a long time been complicit in many of these activities. And certainly this week we see discussion from Hollywood of a movie on Gary Webb and the Dark Alliance story related to intelligence agency narcotic trafficking into South Central LA. And we're also watching a meltdown of an LAPD policeman, a former policeman, who died this week as the manhunt ended with a cabin burning down in the woods where a former policeman Dorner was said to be hiding out. So what's going on in LAPD, we don't know, but it's very interesting that this is happening in the same week. A lot of controversy around that 2007, as I said, 2007 settlement for $660 million with the Archbishop having to reach and pay or sell a headquarter and reach into the cemetery fund and take money from investments in the cemetery fund. These kinds of things, again, very devastating to donations in a very important area, very rich area, very important area for the church. I often refer to the Godfather series. I always say that if you want to understand the U.S. economy in 1980, you want to watch the Godfather series. The most illuminating of the three Godfather series is Godfather 3. And again, it focuses on this theme of being one degree of separation from the cash flows on the street to the top of the Vatican. And I think we are truly seeing a play of that story at this week as the resignation of the Pope reminds us of the pain of what's happening in the cash flows and sort of this change and reengineering that has to occur if the legacy economy bureaucracies are to survive. I sent directions this week to our cartoonist and said, look, I want you to try and make a cartoon. And I wanted to read you the instructions I sent him because it'll give you a sense of the challenge that's now facing the church leaderships. So I said, pretend that we have the Knights of Malta and Opus Dei gathering to discuss the perfect pope. What would the perfect pope look like? Because we are now going to watch the choosing of a new church, of a new pope, and that's going to be a signal as to the kind of reengineering and evolution the church is going to have to go through. So let me just read you my instructions. After 2,000 years of tax exemption and diplomatic immunity and the accumulated capital thereon, the money men behind the church need the right man for the job. First, he sells in the emerging markets. He's younger, more multicultural. He can bring in donors in the economies that are growing. He attracts priests and nuns, read low-cost labor, so he will agree to let them have sex. He will provide a clean break with a pedophilia scandal so the litigation costs and settlements will stop bleeding the money. He will attract back the member and ties that have left because of the scandals and the older grumpiness of the church. He knows how to work the media so the likes of Time Warner and Hollywood cannot break the bank. He will preserve the brand so that sovereign governments don't threaten the church and investment syndicates, diplomatic immunity, and tax-free status. He will understand that in the day of modern technology, the confessional and pedophilia networks are no longer the most cost-effective ways of building a powerful control file system globally. Indeed, he is technologically sophisticated enough to know how to protect the church networks from the invasive technology of competing networks looking to build alternative control file networks and related money laundering without the diplomatic status and tax exempt status. note major loss of intellectual capital value to the competition going on here thanks to new technology. He will find ways to outcompete Islam without requiring that the U.S. military and intelligence community bankrupt the U.S. government. Don't underestimate the importance of the Vatican sort of financial meltdown with the U.S. fiscal cliff. As the U.S. is having to re-engineer the defense budget, they can't begin to spend as much money campaigning against Islam as they did or as they have in the last 10 years, and don't underestimate the importance of that to the church, because one of the things that triggered the war on terror was that Islam was growing in terms of membership much faster and more significantly than Christendom and the church. He will look more open to and inclusive to women, minorities, gay people, all races and creeds, even be tolerant to birth control, euthanasia, on a wink, abortion, stem cells. He will look open, but the Vatican Library and all it tells about who and what really runs this world, suppressed technology, and the true nature of the Vatican real estate and investment holdings will be as secret as ever and more, paren, that is, Jesus need not apply. He needs to be photogenic and give a good speech. He needs to understand who is the boss, not him. He needs to be on board to use the Vatican's significant real estate interests in Europe and America to reinflate the real estate markets as new technology is integrated, and that includes transferring some of it to the right private networks. As the new technology is rolled out, members of millions of people are unemployed. He needs to attract lots of new members from the disenfranchised. Obama engineered $27 trillion of gifts to the banks and to the breakaway civilization, correct? He gives a young, pretty face to the conquest and depopulation of Africa. He's got the Patriot Act assassinating America's torture on a sustainable path. Why can't we get someone just like him, someone who knows how to tweet? So, plan on the church getting someone much more in the style of Obama to take the New World Order to the next level. On the theory that the mighty have fallen not just at the Vatican, it was announced this week that the Bush personal family email has been hacked with lots of photographs of George W. Bush's paintings coming out. But my guess is a lot more interesting stuff was garnered. And it's a notation of sort of what happens when someone like George H.W. Bush ends up in the hospital for 2 months, and we're really seeing a transfer of power through the generations. The State of the Union happened this week. In terms of packaging, it was absolutely brilliant. A great amount of taxpayer money went to the social media marketing and the efforts to make the information clear and understandable. Tremendous impact an investment on describing things not clearly as to what they are, but in response to what the polls show concern. The number one interest of the polls was to listen to the economy and jobs, no interest in hearing the control agenda. And so everything was promoted under the philosophy of it's good for the middle class and it's good for jobs, which was complete hooey. But I have to tell you, it sounded absolutely wonderful. Even though if you understood what was really going on in terms of real hard policy proposals and money, I have to tell you, it was one of the most evil speeches I've ever heard. There was a lot of focus on clean energy as well as tax reform. Now, the word carbon tax was never said and the word key pipeline was never said, but I'll bet you dimes to donuts the combination of energy and tax reform means a push for the carbon tax, so beware. Behind the attractive words and the spin, there was real emphasis on control, control, control. Again, I think the reason that Obama got the nod in the election was he promised extraordinary controls, controls on the internet, controls through the carbon tax, which will be devastating for the middle class. Controls through healthcare insurance mandates and through gun control. But fascism was never marketed more brilliantly than it was in the State of the Union. I have a commentary up on the blog, so with plenty of links if you want to go check it out. At exactly the same time as the State of the Union rolls out, Bloomberg rolls out an entire clean energy site. That's also up on the blog. And what that tells you is that this clean energy and new energy technology is absolutely coming. There is also, both in the State of the Union and since the State of the Union, numerous statements by the president about manufacturing and bringing manufacturing back to America. And from what I believe is that's the push to roll out robotics, as we've talked about here on the Solari Report, both in the wrap-up and since the wrap-up, but plan on tremendous new automation coming to manufacturing in North America this year. Speaking of meltdowns in the legacy economy, the European Union and U.S. announced that they are launching free trade talks. This is big. This is going to be a free trade agreement along the lines of GATT, the Uruguay round of GATT or NAFTA. This could have extraordinary impacts on the economies in the developed world. And it reflects, again, a similar kind of meltdown that we're seeing globally. North Korea, lots of feedback from North Korea testing a nuclear weapon. As one commentator said, every once in a while they have to remind us that they exist and have a temper tantrum. But it's a reminder, if you study military policy, that we're in an environment where a remarkably few group of people can get together with relatively little resources and do a great deal of damage. Finally, The Economist did a very positive thing. They created on their website a debate on fracking, pro and con, which is something the world really needs to do, particularly in North America. If you look at the economics of the dollar and our debt position and our economy, we are benefiting tremendously from fracking technology and what is made possible with an explosion of oil and gas drilling, much more economic, much more efficient. And yet there are very deep concerns about environment and water and how the fracking is being handled. And those issues need to be debated out at a very complex level. So 2 points to The Economist for doing that. Our hero this week is someone I've long been an admirer of and like tremendously, Ivan Peter, who is an entrepreneur, activist, and former chief of his Indian tribe in Alaska. I know him through Foster and Kimberly Gamble, the producers of Thrive, and as I said, have liked him enormously for years. This weekend on our panel in Los Angeles, Kimberly was describing the decision-making process. He taught her from how their tribe makes decisions. They don't operate by majority, but consensus. However, one of the problems with consensus decision-making, any entrepreneur knows, is that you need to move to action far more quickly than you can ever get dissension. What Yvonne told Kimberly was they proceed to move to action quickly based on things like majority, but what they do is they keep the dissenter's voice at the table. And so when the group gathers, in this case, the equivalent of a city council, when the council gathers, they keep the dissenting opinion on the table until a consensus is finally reached. And I think that's a very lovely thing to do for decision-making, because often if you just move for majority, the majority might be right, but you also may miss something. And so what a great idea. And a reminder that in the governance process, Evan is always, in my experience, someone who brings a lot to the table. Ask Catherine. We have several questions for Franklin, and so I'm gonna defer those for our discussion with Franklin. So, Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Okay. Okay, well, I was going to have dinner with you and be over in Middle Tennessee, but I thought I would save you getting my cold. But you and I are both in Tennessee. What?
I appreciate that very much.
Anyway, so Franklin, you know, I have to say the gold and silver market this month has absolutely... you know, I'm still just shaking my head, so I, too, am looking forward to your report tonight. Bring us down. Tell us what's been going on in the last month.
Well, a lot depends on your perspective. You know, if you were a Japanese holder of gold, you saw gold recently hit its all-time high. So,
right.
Always, all depends on your outlook, your standpoint. The gold market today is about at about a two-thirds correction of the run that it made from the low and near the end of May till the peak in October, right at the 1st of October. So this is not the end of the world. You know, for some reason there was a concerted attack on me today, and I got several communications informing me that gold and silver were about to go over the cliff. Maybe, you know, silver would go to $12 or $14, something like that, and gold to $950, I think, was the most extreme. Well, you know, I've been here before is all I can say. Fall of 2008, I sat there and watched silver from the March high by October. Silver lost 105% of its previous rise. Gold lost 30%. So, you know, I've been here before. It's not unusual to have long, drawn-out corrections. This is, as far as the length of these, they're in line with corrections that we previously saw. So I know it's frustrating. It's frustrating for me, too. This week has been especially, the gold market's been especially vulnerable because it's Chinese New Year, and Chinese traders are out of the market, and they're, you know, generally strong buyers. And also, we've got this blasted Gang of 20 meeting coming up, and that's got not just the gold and silver markets spooked, but it's got the currency markets and spooked, and the stock markets very much confused. They all, stock markets around the world were either off today or flat. So, because nobody knows what kind of surprise party those people are going to throw. Now, you and I know that they're not going to make any permanent changes in anything, that the system of borrowing and spending and heavy indebtedness and inflation, all of that's going to continue. So whatever did come out of this meeting wouldn't have much of an effect. If I look a little further at the gold, at the gold and silver market, there's fairly strong support around 1625. So, you know, we're not there yet. In the silver market, there's fairly strong support around $30, $29.75, and we're not there yet either. But you have to reckon that if this continues for another month or so, silver might go down as low as 29.50, and the gold might go down as low as 15.95. I don't think we're necessarily going to see that, but there it is. More interesting.
Right. I wanted to mention that I told you this earlier. We Chuck Gibson went back and charted out the bull market for the last 12 years. So just went back and looked over the last 12 years, and we're in the third consolidation, and the first one lasted 16 and a half months, the second lasted 17 and a half months, and we're just now approaching 17 and a half months. And I think if you say, okay, well, let's give it 18 and a half months, my question is, if we don't start turning up between March and June, what's that going to say? That's a change in pattern, but not yet, because now, if you look at the trading patterns, it looks like you were in the third of those consolidations and nothing's changed.
Well, you mean when you say something has changed, you're thinking about whether the primary trend has ended.
Well, I think that if you look at the timing of the current consolidation, we should be in the end of the third consolidation. And there's nothing, if you look at the timing of where we are, there's nothing different than, you know, the normal consolidation pattern we've had, and this is the third one, which is to be expected. So what it says is where we are is, you know, I'm not sure if typical is the right word, but typical. And if the primary trend continues, which we expect it to do, it should do so by June. Is what that says to me.
Well, yeah, that moves into kind of troublesome time of the year, though, for what's usually a slow time of the year for silver and gold, but it certainly can do that. You know, those yearly patterns are not written in granite or something, so they can alter.
Right.
I'm looking let me just throw something in that mix. I look at the Dow divided by gold, or in other words, the Dow measured by gold, and the Dow measured by silver, and they frankly have been very, very difficult to read because they've been very jumpy or gappy. And as I look at those, they indicate that stocks are going to gain on silver and gold, probably another 5 to 6%. And right now, the stocks have slowed down, as I said, this week, but they're trying to go straight up. And I think they'll probably go to 14.5, or the Dow will probably go to 14.5 or 15,000. For reasons I've explained over and over, I think that'll be the top of it, and they'll start falling again. But the Dow measured in gold and the Dow measured in silver both indicate that there's a little more time to run on this. How much longer? I don't know. I think the stock's run would be over by end of June, end of March. And then silver and gold can, you know, start to move up from there.
You know what you just said, Franklin, oddly enough? You just said that the price of an ounce of gold and the price of the S&P 500 should come into parity. Well, I've always wondered if that was one of the, you know, I've always said the central bankers don't want precious metals to get too far ahead of the equity markets. And I've always wondered if that was going to be one of their tools, was to kind of keep a parity between the S&P 500 and the price of gold.
Well, it'll work for a while, but I don't think it'll work for long. I think stocks are severely overbought here, and they're ready to stumble. And, you know, I want you to think about the last 2 years. You've seen stocks and gold moving together quite a bit. And
well, they did up until the beginning of last year, and then they broke pattern. They fractured.
So, see, that's not the sort of thing that happens in a major gold advance. That it can happen in a correction like this when largely the gold market doesn't have much direction, and if it does have any direction, it's down. But this is all, you know, this is correction behavior. This is not. And then you'll see a change and become rally behavior. But I would remind you that, you know, the last time we had a correction, gold and silver went from, well, they rose, so silver rose about 6 times and gold rose about 2.7 times. So there's a lot of good territory in front of us, and it would be very difficult for me to believe that this primary trend was already over, because it just hasn't gained enough. Neither market has gained enough to constitute a peak. And besides, there are too many people now who think the end has come for gold and silver. And you don't ever see that, you know, right at the top. So it's been tough. It's hard. It's not fun. But I've been here before. And, you know, you just have to. You have to go back and check your premises about the primary trend, and if none of the causes have changed, then the effects won't change.
Right. It's clear that the central banks and sovereign governments are committed to inflation as a policy. I think the one thing that concerns me is that part of what you're watching is a shrinkage in the multiplier effect, nothing to do with central bank and government policy in this sense, but literally in a loss of faith in the system very broadly. I mean, I was talking about the Vatican, that's an example. But we're literally seeing a meltdown of the cash flows and asset values in the legacy economy. And a lot of that, Franklin, is because people just don't believe. They have been too, you know, shocked and disturbed by the agenda of control. You know, there's nothing that diminishes economic values more than the police state. And if you look at the policies, I just think you've got a real concern with lawlessness. I don't know if in the last 6 months you've priced the price of ammunition, but I have to tell you, if when gold hit the high in April 2011, you know, you took all that money and went out and bought bullets. you know, that ammunition is what has gotten the by far the most incredible performance. I know a group of guys who went out and bought a carload of ammunition. You know, to me, that's the all-star investment of the last 2 years. So have you priced out ammunition recently?
We went to a gun show a few weekends ago, and we got there about 5 minutes before it opened at 9 o'clock. There was a quarter of a mile line of people going in, and rounds that ought to go for, that ought to sell for about 20 cents a piece were selling for anywhere from, you know, 80 cents to a dollar.
I know. It's incredible.
I interviewed Larry Pratt this week, who is the head of gun owners of, who is the director of Gun Owners of America.
Right.
And he said that he sees them go into gun shows with dollies.
Yep.
They go in with dollies. They load up the dolly with cases of ammunition and take it out the door. So, yeah, that is definitely a sign that support for the regime or faith in the regime is decreasing. And you know, I see the same thing, though. Maybe the people I talk to are not typical, but they call me up and the first words out of their mouth, I've never done this before, but I'm just afraid the dollar's going to collapse. I've never done this before, but I just don't trust our government. I've never done this before, but I don't trust the banks. Now, you can't have that kind of sentiment widespread in an efficient and well-working system, I don't think.
So no, you can't.
And then with this latest campaign of Obama for gun control, who's he trying to protect?
I'll tell you who he's trying to protect, because if you look at the patterns of behavior, he's made a deal. The way he got the nod from Mr. Global to win the election, because that came top, you know, Obama won the election top down. And that came because he made a deal, and he made a deal to deliver control in a variety of ways. And the reason it's important, as I said, is now that you've foreclosed and through the sort of pump and dump of real estate, gotten control of massive amounts of real estate holdings at very low price, either because you foreclosed and grabbed or, you know, somebody has to sell it a song, you're in a position to reposition the real estate. And those investors, when they go in, you know, if I go in and pick up a house in a bulk deal from Fannie Mae at $100,000 when the servicer refused to do a renegotiation with the homeowner at $300,000 after that guy's been pumped and dumped and fraudulently induced and all sorts of stuff, you know, they're going to be mad. And if they own guns, the real estate investors are not going to feel real bullish about that. So they want the guns pulled in, because they want to pick up the land, they want to pick the homes, and they want to pick them up at a song and practice eminent domain and do all of these things. And they just don't want to be worried about someone who has guns who can implement a tax escrow or, you know, question the transfer of that piece of real estate. So as you can tell, I have a strong opinion on this. I thought it was a condition, and they've promised it, and they have to deliver. They have to deliver because this was a promise. So we're talking about something that's going to turn into an unbelievable food fight, because I don't think they can win this one. But I think they're going to have to go to the mat, which means, you know, the American people are going to have to go to the mat, and I think that's going to happen.
Just buttressing your argument there, I don't know if I ever told you that when Obama first started to run, I laughed. And I had to laugh because he had no experience. He was less qualified than Dwight David Eisenhower was qualified to be general of all the armies of the Allies.
He was profiled, but he had the right profile, Franklin.
one of my customers down in Texas, Austin, I think, he went down there and had a rally. And this fellow reported on it to me, and he said, you know, there's big, big money behind him.
Big, big money.
Giant place. There weren't many people there, but they rented this giant place. They were handing out expensive T-shirts, and he picked off about four or five things that indicated big bucks had been behind him. And that just made me sort of catch my breath and think, ooh, surely not. Well, surely.
Yeah, no, very, very. Well, think about it. Barack Obama's presidency delivered $27 trillion of gifts and loans to the bank. That is, I would say that is the most phenomenal political feat of any U.S. president ever. And you've got all the younger generation saying he's terrific. When he just took the accumulated capital of their parents' and grandparents' retirement savings that was destined to be theirs and instead gave it to the banks. And yet the kids love him. That's a pretty amazing political feat.
Well, it is.
Okay, well, let me turn you, because we need to talk about shipping. And I can just hear everybody and all the Solaris scribers saying, shipping? Why are you talking about shipping? And the reason I want to talk about shipping is I've seen shipping cause so much heartburn to people buying precious metals or selling precious metals or swapping precious metals that I said, okay, let's just go through the 411 of shipping one time, because getting this right can make a very big difference. And, you know, on a very rare occasion, you see something go terribly wrong and it can have catastrophic impacts. So I want to make sure everybody in our network knows how to do shipping. Okay, are we ready to begin?
I'm ready when you are.
Okay.
The problem with shipping silver and gold is that it's a high-value item, and it's difficult to get insurance that will cover the whole thing. And the only shipper that is generally available to the public where you can get sufficient insurance, which is limited to $25,000, is the United States Post Office Registered Mail. You can't get insurance with FedEx for more than, I think, $100. I know it's $100 with UPS. So if you are shipping as an individual, you are constrained, because you do not have a private insurance policy to cover the risk, you're constrained to ship by the United States Postal Service. Now, the United States government, as we all know, is not the best partner to have in any business deal. And we found that out back in September. We used to ship, it was slightly, you know, the point of price efficiency was about $600. And below that, it was cheaper to ship insured mail. And above that, cheaper to ship by registered mail. Well, we had shipped a package for $1,000. It was an insured package, and it was lost, which, by the way, is always a bigger problem with insured mail, because it doesn't go under a locked pouch. It's just thrown in with everybody else. And apparently, after you leave the post office, they put another sticker on the package that says, "Steal me, there's something valuable inside." But we had a claim for $1,000, and the first we found out that they were no longer insuring gold and silver by insured mail was when they sent us a check against our $1,000 claim for $16.95, which was the amount of the postage. So there was no announcement made, nothing. They just reneged on the deal. The post office did. So that meant we had to ship everything now. That means we have to ship everything now by registered mail, again, unless you have private insurance.
Now, the limit on the postal insurance is $25,000. So the most anybody can... Go ahead.
The most insurance you can get is $25,000, which means if you're trying to ship $100,000 worth of gold, you've got to ship in four different packages. If you're trying to ship
right.
200,000, you have to ship in eight packages, and so forth. So, it's a real limitation. And when gold and silver were much higher than they are now, it meant you had to use a lot more packages. As far as registered risk with registered mail has to be signed for. It has a number on it, and everyone who touches that piece of mail has to sign for it. It travels under a locked pouch, and so it doesn't get lost. In the 30-something years I've been dealing in silver and gold, we've lost not more than 8 packages, and one of those was in a registered pouch that was stolen from where the entire pouch was stolen from the Boston airport. So that's not really, you know, we have very few losses with the United States Postal Service.
So let me just interrupt because let me say one thing on that. It's important to understand it takes up to 6 months to collect your insurance. So let's say I'm trying to ship gold coins back to you or my dealer, and so I'm the shipper. I have insurance for $25,000. The package gets lost. It takes me 6 months to collect. If gold's rising during that period, I don't have $25,000 in gold ounces. I've got $25,000 in dollars. So, you know, it can go the wrong way on me whether I'm buying or selling. And that's one important thing to remember because it does take a long time to collect, even though the odds are very small. I just want to make sure everybody understands that that is a risk.
Right. And generally the shipper is the one who collects the insurance. That is, if you bought the package and it's addressed to you, the insurance does not run in your, you're not the beneficiary of the insurance. The person who shipped
right.
it is the beneficiary of the insurance.
Right. right.
So yes, there is, the post office especially has a long delay. And I don't know why they do this. They tell people, when they ship something to us, they tell them, oh, it'll be there in 2 days, maybe three. Well, it's never there in 2 or 3 days. 7 days is really good for the post office. And it can take up to 2 weeks, and they won't even begin an inquiry until 30 days has passed from the time it shifted. Their tracking system is a joke. All you can find out is that the package was supposed to be delivered on such and such a date, and when it's 4 days after that or 6 days after that, and you're staring at the computer screen, you wonder who's in charge. but I'm trying to make, you know, I'm trying to make the point that a lot of people are nervous about the post office. The post office is really pretty good about it.
Right. I find them to be very, very reliable.
Yeah, they really are. But when
right.
you deliver that package, what you're going to find is there's going to be some nosy clerk who may say something like, boy, that's really heavy. What you got in there, gold or silver? And here's, or they'll say, what is in here? You do not have to answer that question. And I'd never answer the question. I would say heavy stuff. Or machine parts. It's not any of their business what's in there. There's only one question you have to ask, and that is if they ask if there's anything liquid or dangerous, and you say no. But generally, I
right.
just say, really, it's really not important. It's valuable stuff. So they, you know, and sometimes when they hand the package over to you, when you have to go pick the package up, they'll say stupid things like that. But generally, they're very efficient, if a little slow, about what they do. UPS, on the other hand, you know, those UPS drivers, I think, are graded on how many packages they deliver in a day. So that's the reason why when you see them, it looks like the soles of their feet are on fire. They're going from one foot to the other because they're carrying up the day for place. And what they will do is, even though I can't tell you how many times I've gotten hot calls from people saying, listen, I came home and I found a $15,000 bag of silver in a bucket sitting on my front porch, and I never use the front door. I always come around the side door, and it's been out there I don't know how many days. Well, what happened was the UPS fella just took a chance, and, you know, even though it's the stamped on the top, adult signature required, he just left it because he's got to go into his next stop.
That's happened to me. I've had them leave packages on the doorstep in the middle of the city, just in the middle of a very urban environment, and you think, oh, my word, there must have been angels watching over this.
Well, it's very strange. We've never lost a UPS package. Never the first time. I had never lost a FedEx package. I'm sure they lose packages like anybody.
Now, when you're shipping, when the dealer is shipping UPS or FedEx, they have business insurance, so it's covered?
They have private insurance, right.
They have private insurance because one of our questions says, oh, my word, I got $100,000 of coin. Are you saying it wasn't insured? And if it's coming from a dealer may have that insurance and may have it covered.
Right, and he may have $5,000, $25,000 package limit, but usually the limit is $50,000 or $100,000 on one package, because you can very easily put $100,000 worth of gold into one package.
So if I order $100,000 from a dealer, and he sends it FedEx and it gets lost, am I liable or is he liable? I'm assuming the dealer's liable.
Well, it's his insurance. He's the one that has to make the claim. Right.
Right. So, but he's got to deliver me the coins, and if his shipper loses it, it's not my problem.
That's not your problem, no.
Right. Right. Okay.
So, but it runs, and you know, the insurance, again, he's the only one that can make a claim because he's the one who's got the insurance. So, and then sometimes with shipping, if it's a really large order, the insurance rule is that you can't ship all of it to a person in one day. Let's just say they have 15 bags of silver that you were going to ship to them. They don't want you to ship more than, say, 7 bags or 6 bags in a day. And that varies from insurer to insurer, but it's understandable. They don't want it all arriving at the same time. So if it's a really big order, then they ship in tranches.
Okay, now let's talk about delivering, who you deliver to, because I can deliver to my house, I can deliver to my post office box, but I may not have my post office box at the U.S. Post Office. I may have it at UPS, and we don't want anybody delivering to a UPS or mail or any of the private mailboxes, correct?
Well, I personally don't like that, and the reason you've raised something else I'll get to in a minute, but the reason is, and when everybody gives me a personal mailbox address, I tell them, are you absolutely sure that you trust the people there? Because once this is signed for, if it's addressed to that personal, to you at that personal mailbox, I don't care who signs for it, it's yours. You sign for it. And then if that person goes off with it, that's your problem, not mine.
Right.
And I tell them just exactly that way, because they need to understand that that's the only responsibility I have, is to deliver to the address that they give me. We had something else that's really, I've never had a problem with a personal mailbox. And apparently most of the folks who have them trust the people who run them. But I have had trouble delivering to third parties, and I just won't do that. Not anymore. We had a case of a woman who, you know, they've listened to these numismatic dealers who've got them so terrified that the government is looking over their shoulder to see what little dab of gold they're buying, that, you know, they go to all these links so that the gold or silver is not delivered to their personal address. I think that's a huge mistake. Because number one, I don't think the government cares that much. And number two, if they want to watch you, they can watch you some other way. But the biggest reason I think that's a bad idea is because that person may run off with your stuff.
Right.
Don't tell me it won't happen, because we had a lady who apparently was, you know, I don't know if she was handicapped or older or what, but she had a friend, a third-party friend, who was actually a friend of a friend, and she had to send about $70,000 to that address, and the friend of a friend ran off with it. And, you know, there was nothing I could do about it, and she wound up in a lawsuit trying to get it back. So, and then the same thing happened again a number of years ago. A fella had some, bought some platinum, and oh, he was another one of those people very, you know, very spooky about his privacy, and he had it shipped to a friend. And in about 2 months, long after he ought to have had it, he's on my phone fussing at me about how it never was delivered. Well, we go back to the post office, we get proof of delivery, we say, here it is, and the friend is still telling him, no, I never got it, I never got it, I never got it. And about 4 months later, the friend is rummaging around in the trunk of his car and finds the package.
Oh, my word.
You know, and there's $20,000 worth of platinum that's been riding around the back of his car with his jack and his tire iron all this time. So you need to have, if you're going to have a third party receive a package for you, it must be a reliable third party. Your attorney, maybe.
Now, just one, hold up just a second. One thing I tell people is never, ever, ever send it to a law firm. Because I did have a dear friend, and you know this case, who made that mistake, sending it to a law firm in an area famous for money laundering and other criminal activities, and sure enough, a week or two later, it got stolen out of his house. I just think, I do not think a law firm is a safe place to send it into. So, I would be very careful about that. Unless it's a...
The package does not come with a label on the outside that says, I have gold and silver inside.
But right.
It's a plain brown wrapper, and it may be a little bit heavy, but it doesn't really say what it is.
Right.
So, most people who work for the post office, and certainly those who work for UPS or FedEx, are way too busy to worry about what you're getting. It's just too much. They have too many other fish to fry. So that's the reason why I would not be worried as a gold and silver investor about taking delivery of it myself. As far as having it to a post office box, here's the difference there. If you have a post office box in a U.S. post office, then what they're going to do is they're going to put a notification, a little yellow slip, in your box when it arrives, and then you take that slip to the clerk's window and you pick up the package. If you don't do that, if you have it delivered to your house, then they're going to deliver it to your house, and if you're not there, they will leave that same kind of slip, and then you have to go to the post office and pick it up.
Right.
So, then it becomes just a matter of what's convenient for you.
Okay, now we have very little time and a whole ton of questions, so I'm just going to run through these. Would love to hear anything else on shipping before I move on to the questions. The only other thing I would add is make sure if you're sending silver, if you're sending big cans of 90% silver, you need to make sure to package it, because I've seen a lot of packaging tear apart on the weight. So just make sure you pack it right. It's the only thing I would add.
When when anyone ships anything for us, any of our customers ship anything, we send them a detailed letter. It's about 4 pages long about exactly how to ship it. And if you follow those instructions, it's going to get there.
Okay. Okay, if anybody wants a copy of that, can they just email you?
Just tell them to ask for the generic shipping instructions. Just put
that
in the subject line and I'll send it to them.
Okay, terrific. Would love to hear Franklin's comments on Joseph Farrell's postulation that there is much more gold in the world than officially recorded, former Nazi and Chinese, Japanese gold, and the impact that would have not so much on the gold price, but on gold as an investment. Take it away.
Okay. Well, they're really referring to this whole, to a book called Gold Warriors, and there's some other books too. In fact, I've got a copy of Gold Warriors in my hand right now. The Japanese and the Germans, to a lesser degree, looted Asia and Europe of all the gold they could get. They also got platinum, they got foreign currencies, they got jewelry. The Japanese buried it in 150 different places in the Philippines. For some reason, they thought they were going to hold on to the Philippines after the war. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars. And the estimates are not clear to me from reading the book, but I've seen figures like 110 tons. 110,000 tons versus the 25,000 tons that central banks admit to having or claim to have as their reserves. So that would be more than 4 times as much. But I'm sure that the stories are true about the gold caches, that Japanese would dig tunnels and bury this stuff, and then they use slave laborers, and when they had filled them with gold and whatever else they were going to put in there, they would just shut the thing up, just close the thing up, and the slave laborers would die inside. A number of these have been found, but what happened was after the war, the Americans, both with the Nazi gold and with the Japanese gold, created slush funds. The government created slush funds to use in the Cold War world. So what that means is that the gold that the American government recovered, rather than going to the benefit of the victims of those two war machines, went into a kind of secret slush fund for the intelligence communities. Now, they didn't just bury that in the ground somewhere. They deposited that in banks all over the world. And so that gold is out there. It's, in other words, the gold is in circulation. It's not as if there's a closet somewhere with 110,000 tons of gold waiting to come into circulation. It's already out there somewhere. And who knows if that would ever be enough to make up for all the paper gold that they've issued.
Right. What it means is the collateral fraud may not be as extraordinary as we think. But if you look at the sort of any estimate of the collateral fraud in the gold markets, it's so absolutely enormous. You know, if anything, you breathe a sigh of relief if the and it's really Sterling Seagrave hypothesis is true. But I agree with you, it's been out there working for the breakaway civilization. They're not, you know, they're not sitting on it. Another question. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's interesting that all of a sudden that book is getting a lot of play.
It's very interesting. When I was out in L.A., everybody was quoting it. Everywhere I go, everybody's suddenly quoting that book. And the book's been out for – Sterling and Peggy wrote that book a long time ago. It's been circulating for a long time. And all of a sudden, it's fashionable just as there's a great effort to push the price of gold down. It's very – you know, it's coinkadinky.
Right. So, I mean, it looks like the reason that it's being brought up is to push down the gold price.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, next question. Gold going to 4,500. What could possibly go wrong?
Nothing.
Well, I don't believe gold is going to 4,500 because I don't think the market clears with price. I think it clears with war. I think if in the next 6 months you had gold hit, I've said this before, if you had gold hit 2,500, you'd have war rather than a higher price of gold. So I just think you can't let the bond market melt down, and you let gold spiral up too high too fast, and that's exactly what's going to happen.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's going to 4,500 tomorrow, but if you think about it, the price has been somewhat managed from a six-fold increase has been managed, and the world has not blown up, and the bond market has not melted down. So from the standpoint of the Fed and the people who manage the currency, that's success, isn't it?
Right.
In other words, they don't care what the price of gold is. They don't care how low the dollar goes. All they care about is don't let the world blow up on my watch.
Right.
And it hasn't blown up yet. So
right.
I have to say, I think $4,500 is certainly a price you'll see on gold. Now, how much those dollars will buy is, of course, another question.
Okay. It turns out we've got a whole raft of new shipping questions. Let me send them to you.
Okay.
From the fellow who was talking about receiving 100,000 of gold. So when you sell metals back to your dealer, does your dealer have insurance for you? The answer is no. You've got to arrange it, and that's one reason why you'll probably use the post office to ship it back. Is that not correct?
Most of the time. It's not always correct. Sometimes.
The dealer can arrange to pick it up and
The dealer can arrange for his insurance to cover it. But okay. As a general matter, you ought to count on having to use the post office.
How much gold or silver does it take until suddenly it becomes economic to use somebody like Brinks?
A lot. An awful lot. At about 100 bags, you're going to break even. At 100 bags, that's about $250,000. And it may be less than that. You know, I mean, the silver, of course, you've got weight involved. But Brinks is not easy to use. Brinks does right. not want to do retail business. And so you have to go to a Brinks location, or they will come only to a business location, not to a personal residence, and pick things up.
But that business location has to have an account, right?
No, they don't have to have an account. It just has to be a business address. In other words, it has to
So I can have Brinks deal. Delivered to me standing at my bank, for example.
No, I don't think so. No, they want, you know, if you've got a business address and an office building, not an office, but, you know, a business, they want you to have a business. It has to be a business address. And they are not okay. easy to work with.
Right, I know.
They're not. You know,
well, the other thing is they're also limited to a shipment. Lloyd's limits shipments to a $5 million insurance limit.
Well, that hasn't been a problem for me yet.
Okay.
But I hope it becomes one.
Okay.
A little bit of two shipment. But, you know, this is going to sound crazy, but the two fellas that I learned to trade from were the most low-key two people I've ever seen. One of them was a dentist, and the other one was just just did an office job. And the two of them looked together like they didn't have enough money that I had to borrow money to make a phone call. And
right.
they would put $50,000 worth of silver in this old beat-up station wagon and drive from, you know, halfway across the country with it to deliver it somewhere. So, I don't recommend doing that, but I've had customers who do that sort of stuff. And, what you have to understand is, and what a lot of them don't seem to understand is, when you do that, instead of paying the post office $40 to take $25,000 worth of risk for you delivering something halfway across the country, you're taking that risk on yourself.
Right.
And so.
Right, I'd much rather transfer it to the post office box. Okay, so I got more questions, so I got to race. Is local pickup an option? Can I arrange for somebody to do a local pickup? So can I arrange for, if the dealer will insure, for FedEx or UPS to pick it up locally?
I've never done that. If the dealer's going to cover the insurance, yes, I suppose you could. I'm not sure I'd want to do that. I would rather deliver it myself.
Right. Okay, so one interesting story. I've lost a FedEx package from Kitco in Canada, stolen in customs, Kitco reshipped, and FedEx supervisor tracked it personally. So that's an FYI. One fellow just reported his order and pricings on ammunition, which is very interesting. And then one question. I've been hearing that the bond market charts show that the bond market may collapse in June. How do you think this will affect us?
The bond market has broken out. It's the 10-year yield is the one I watch, and it has definitely broken out above 2%. And if it gets over 2.4%, then there's going to be trouble for Ben Bernanke. Will have big trouble. Because what it will say is that the bond market is not buying the zero interest rate policy. And when they start selling those bonds, when people start selling those bonds, that interest rate is going to go up. So,
right. Now, what are higher interest rates going to do to the price of gold and silver?
Well, you know, I can't say to you that everything that if this happens in interest rates, that happens in gold and silver
right.
in any simplistic way. Because because if you've got a low inflation rate, high interest rates are bad for gold and silver because the opportunity cost of holding the gold and silver goes up. But oftentimes high interest rates are associated, in fact, they usually are associated with high inflation rates. So
Right. You
might find that interest rates of 10 or 12% actually push gold and silver higher because what they really reflect is not a high interest rate. They really reflect a high inflation rate that's factored into the interest rate. So it's not just a one-for-one relation where I can say high interest rates are bad for gold and silver because it depends on what the inflationary environment is.
Right. Okay, well, let's quickly turn to let's go to the movies. You want to join me to talk about House of Cards?
I'd like to hear that, but I can't.
Well, I think House of Cards is an extremely interesting development. It is a new series from Netflix starring Kevin Spacey. And believe it or not, it is the number one views on Netflix right now. It's a huge and phenomenal success. I've seen the first five of the series. There were two seasons ordered by Netflix, the first each season being 13 episodes. Interestingly enough, Franklin, they posted all 13 at once, so you can watch it at your leisure, the whole first season. They've ordered two seasons, so there's going to be 13 more for a total of 26. It is very well and cleverly done. Kevin Spacey is absolutely fantastic. For any of you who are going to work in Washington or up on the Hill as a congressional staffer, it is the best primer on how life on the Hill really works. It's remarkable. Kevin Spacey is the majority whip. He's a Democratic congressman from Georgia who has been promised the Secretary of State. The president reneges after the election. That's in the first or second series, and he vows to get revenge. It's very interesting to watch him go about doing it. He's a man who can operate at the highest level of government, but also get down to his rural district in Georgia and deal with the peach farmers. His dad was a peach farmer. And so this is a man, I go back to this philosophy of, you know, going from the top of the system down to the street and back and doing it in one degree of separation. And we see the same theme in the political context that we see in the Vatican and Godfather 3 or some of these other stories. And so it's really quite remarkable. And so it says a lot about the disgorging of information about the real deal through fiction. I always say fact is, in America, fact is fiction and fiction is fact. But you can see that the customer, the viewers want a lot more information on the real deal and what's really going on, and they certainly get it in spades in House of Cards. The other thing that's interesting about this, Franklin, is it really has an incredible comment about the future of TV, because you watch this whole thing when you want to watch it, and there are no stupid ads. You don't have to be bothered with all those crazy interruptions. We see Intel announcing this week that it's going to start a TV series. We have enormous streaming now being done through Amazon, Apple with a TV series, and saying they're going to spend a lot more time and money developing the TV side of their business. And so we're really watching the online businesses go head-to-head with TV. And I would say the message is they are winning. There's no doubt about it, because this is a real reinvention of how storytelling by video is going to happen in America. And it's remarkable. If you look at the stories coming out of Hollywood about the season that they're working on, it indicates another real focus on the real deal. There's one program called Delirium where it's in the future and love is illegal. And the way that's enforced is they give you a vaccine that prevents you from loving. a real comment on vaccination. So I've seen the first five. I think they're absolutely terrific. Kevin Spacey has really shifted his brand up enormously by doing Margin Call and House of Cards, literally walking away from traditional Hollywood and taking on these, these very unusual productions. And he's hit a home run on both of them. Interestingly enough, Margin Call ends with Kevin Spacey's dog dying, And House of Cards opens up with a dog dying in the beginning scene. So it's almost like a, you know, an artistic connection between the two. One shows you the real deal on Wall Street, and then the other shows you the real deal on Washington. And so, you know, Kevin Spacey has hit a real home run here, and so has Netflix. So I encourage you to watch this, Franklin, because I think you will really laugh, and you will really enjoy it, and you will really see a very sophisticated politician working, you know, as effectively at street level as he does at the top of the global economy. And it's very interesting to watch him try to manage the double binds and the challenges of a world and a culture that is not yet integrated, but is becoming more so every day. Exactly. Well, it's certainly one of the most magical things in the first couple of shows is you have Kevin Spacey. He plays the congresswoman's name is Frances Underwood, and he and his wife are busy being effective within the machinery. So they're walking along day to day, and they're just taking action and getting it done. And if the system and the machinery is psychopathic, they're not trying to be human. They're just saying, hey, it is what it is. I'm just going to go with it, and I'm here to win in the machinery. And then every once in a while, something will happen that makes them realize, well, wait a minute. You know, what's going on here is really psychopathic. And they'll stop and say, well, wait a minute. Something, you know, someone will come along and scream at them because they're trying to insert the human point of view. And they'll kind of look quizzical and say, well, wait a minute. Something's wrong. So you see this tension between a world that is human and sacred and a world that has literally become sociopathic. And there's this creative tension. You wonder how they're going to solve it later. And the way they do it is really quite clever. So anyway, marvelous artistic performance, House of Cards, we recommend it highly. Okay, well, Franklin, thank you so much for joining us on the Soleri Report. We'll be with you next month with the Precious Metals Market Report in March. We're looking forward to it.
Well, thanks. Listen, could I give a little plug for my book?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Take it away.
I have a book that has, I've written a book that says nothing whatever about gold and silver, I promise. The name of the book is At Home in Dogwood Mudhole, and it's about my family's move out here to the country. And all the mistakes we made, all the harrowing escapes we've had. And I've been told it's funny, and so I imagine it must be. But you can buy it at dogwoodmudhole.com. And I think that's almost impossible to forget. But
well, I will say this, because I think it's a marvelous book. To me, Franklin, if you look at the history of the process by which you and I got sort of thrown out of the matrix, we were in a process where we had to leave the matrix and literally start out again from scratch and build a new life and a new career. And it's a faith walk, and it's a very challenging faith walk. And I see that book as very inspiring, because now I think everyone in America is having to go through the same thing. We just got to go through it early. And it's about the faith that it takes to reinvent your world and try and do it in a way which is useful to other people under difficult circumstances, and the challenges and the enormous and extraordinary satisfaction that occurs as it works. You know, so you get the terror, and you get the love, and you get the success, you know, all there in one book. And as you once said on the Soleri Report, how did we become a farmer? We killed a lot of animals. So you get to cry along with the animals as you go through this faith walk. But I think to me it's about how you keep the faith in these kinds of times. And it's, you know, not everybody is going out to the rural areas to become a farmer, but I would say it's as relevant to anybody. You know, whatever the gauntlet you're running, we're all running the same gauntlet as these changes are upon us. And I think it's a very good book to inspire and give you faith about how to go about doing that. So I can't recommend it highly enough. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for tonight's Solari Report. In closing, let me describe a couple of Solari Reports coming up that are going to be terrific. On February 21st, Neil Howe, the author of The Fourth Turning, is joining us. We're going to be calling it How the Newest Generations Will Contribute. He's probably the most famous author globally, talking about the different generations and the impact they're going to have on our economy and culture. So I'm looking very much forward to that. February 28th, I'm going to be helping John Rappaport record his special. We're going to be talking about Dr. Ray Kurzweil's singularity theory and the theory that we're all going to be run by artificial intelligence, computers, and robots. John and I don't buy it. We think it's hooey, but this is, as the robotics and automation rolls out this year, this is a topic that's going to be coming up. Recent article in Wired about how the robots are going to be running all of us. So we think this is a very important conversation to have. March 7th, one of the earliest and most successful cypherpunks, Eric Hughes, talking about the revolution in digital payment systems. We're going to be talking about Bitcoin, wallets, and the move to a digital currency, and the role of the internet in digital payments, and why that how that relates to the politics that are happening in terms of trying to control the internet. Eric Hughes is, when it comes to payment systems, particularly digital transactions, is the most brilliant guy I've ever met. Extraordinary entrepreneur and activist. So until February 21st with Neil Howe and How the Newest Generations Will Contribute, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.